This is Kim Taylor interviewing James Ayers as his involvement as a smoke jumper. How did you get interested in smoke jumping?
Well, I had a job at 16 at St. Regis and was on lookout. We had a fire way back in the mountains there, and so turned out it was a lightning strike, and I followed the old Army artillery method for locating and pinpointing it exactly. I don't know if they still use it in those days. They would count slowly from 12 in cadence, like 13, 14, 15, 16. After you saw the strike, and then you'd stop and you hear the clap of thunder, subtract 12 and divide by 5, and that would give you an amazingly close pinpoint of the fire. So anyway, I hit this one right on the button, and the office actually couldn't understand if this was the same fire, and I think it was, but at least it's an example. I seem to vaguely remember it was all connected, interconnected. But at any rate, so they sent somebody up and they couldn't find it. So they sent in smoke jumpers on it, and I saw the... Well, at any rate, to reiterate, then we just plot right out on the map after we subtracted 12 and divided by 5 after seeing the strike and then hearing the clap of thunder, and so I got this fire right on the nose and turned it in, and they sent the crew foreman up with some men to tackle it by foot, but they couldn't reach it, so they called the jumpers, and it was close enough, the fire was close enough where I could actually see the chutes open. And I was pretty thrilled by it, so I decided from there, if I ever got the opportunity, I'd try to join. I talked with either a dentist or a physician's son in my hometown of Shelby, and he had already mentioned that he'd applied, and so I thought, well, I don't really stand much of a chance, but he, on a buddy-buddy basis, encouraged me to join right along with him, and so I sent in my application, and I didn't meet up with him, but I met up with one of the fellows that worked with me on the St. Regis crew. I was on lookout, and this member was from Ogden, Utah, and he was working trails all season, and he wasn't on lookout. He was a relief lookout, but he wasn't straight lookout, regular lookout man. And so then, when I came down here to the university to go to pre-medical school, and then following summer, then I was taken on with the smoke jumpers under Earl Cooley and Jack Nash, and in the office. And I had some real good foremen, like I remember a man by the name of Barnowski, a very deferential fellow that hardly said two words. He was what they used to call in the old days, I think, sort of a strong, silent type, you know, and everybody used to like to kid him because he was a very slow speaker, and he was awful hard to get ruffled. He had a very calm demeanor, a very calm personality. He was a very fine guy, and he was foreman over me on two or three jumps, and he gave me a good recommendation. So by the second season, then I had this one good recommendation from Mr. Barnowski. And of course, his name, the name itself is sort of appealing. Barnowski is sort of has an appealing flavor to the name, atmosphere to the name. It's kind of interesting because in those days, they mostly did take people with a lot of farm experience. And so I guess that was in the back of our minds, another point to his favor where we really enjoyed being around the man. And so that's pretty well, that was pretty well the influence. Of course, I knew of the forestry department here on campus, and I think I tried to attend the Forester's Ball maybe a time or two, and maybe in the back of my mind I was thinking of changing to forestry, but I just never got around to it. But that pretty well covers the reason for my actually joining. That's all I can really recall.
What did your training entail?
Well, it was pretty well covered in my letters. We had, of course, that tower where they had the makeup straps around the shoulders. And you'd step off the step and had a rope that would bring you up short, and you'd get the feel of a chute opening. You'd get that feeling of the jar from the chute. And then we had the, like I had mentioned, the torture rack. That was, I thought, was a really fine, very excellent for building up one physically. And then we had we had a lot of calisthenics, but we also had, similar to the Army or, say, Fort Bragg, or the paratroopers training, we'd have a bunch of tires out, and we'd have to crisscross our feet and run real fast to put our feet in the space, in the middle space of these tires. And then we had the rope pull. We'd had a high wall, a wood wall, and we'd have to pull ourselves up over this rope in a limited time. All that was very enjoyable, and of course the setting of Nine Mile Camp was really very beautiful. It was set among the pines and the firs there, and former, as I understand, former CC barracks. And I think it was about, it must have been at least dark stained log construction. There must have been about four or five major buildings, including the cook shack and then the overheads office building. And that's about all I can remember. I was up there in 69, was it 69, I think. Well, anyway, I was up there at Nine Mile, but I didn't recognize everything because it was all torn down. The Remont Station looks the same. Of course, that's now the Ranger Station. It's no longer the Remont Station. But at the Remont Station, they had it was pitching hay. That's where they kept all the mules that supplied mules for the Forest Service for, as I understand it, I think I'm correct on this, for Northern. Well, all of Idaho, northern Wyoming, tip of parts of northern Wyoming at least, western part of South Dakota, and the eastern part of Washington State supplied all the mules for that much territory. So that's pretty well my reflections on Nine Mile.
Can you tell us a little bit about the training jumps? What did that entail?
Well, after we had our mock-up, we had like mock-up airplanes, and then we went out to a regular cow pasture airfield, and loaded up, just a dirt strip, airstrip, loaded up. And, first jump was very vivid because it was a beautiful day, and they took us up about the highest I was ever dropped out. Seems it should have been more, but I guess it was. In a letter I told my mother it was 2,000 feet, bright sunny day, but it seemed like it was at least maybe 4,000 or 5,000. Everything looked very soft down there, and appealing and inviting, and I had no problem. I guess, as I understood it, some of the members of the crew used to get quite violently sick, but no one I knew ever did, and I never did, so, because it looked very inviting to me. I enjoyed it. That's all I can remember on that.
Can you remember what some of the general feelings were amongst the jumpers anticipating their first jump?
No, it was quite gung-ho. We had a lot of like servicemen coming back. We had some fellow from Missouri that always, he tried to act like a character, and he'd always say, well, I went out the plane like a big bird. And actually, some of the people had sort of dampen his enthusiasm because he used this phrase, ad nauseum. So finally, somebody in the barracks, finally, when he came in one day, finally told him that, knock it off. It was getting a little bit tiresome, that phrase, I went out of the plane like a big bird, and that sort of business. And I mentioned, I thought, to me at any rate, was that interesting experience I had was a fellow that fought in the Spanish Civil War. He said it was like fighting tanks and guns with sticks, and so I assumed that he was with the Loyalists, which were against Franco's troops, and he parachuted. Evidently, he parachuted. I assume he parachuted. But he was sort of a, what today is termed like a macho male, very assertive, and anyway, my buddies and I were heading into town from 9 Mile Camp. I think Chuck Stelling, well, at least Charles Garrison had a car then. He was the only one in my crowd that did have a car in those days. He had kind of an old, something like an old Dodge or something like that. So this fellow said he wanted to lift into Missoula. We said, sure, fine, come on. But we had the car so loaded up that he had to sit in my lap. Well, he took that as an offense. And he must have been using his legs as sort of a lever because he had those old-fashioned dashboards and old Dodge or whatever it was, and so I assume, because it felt like it was about a 500-pound man was sitting in my lap there, and he was kind of talking a little bit aggressively to either me or everybody. Sort of, I get the impression, I guess it was pretty much everybody, and so, well, I don't know, we finally dropped him off, we got rid of him. I never did see him after that. He just sort of appeared out of the mist and then just sort of disappeared in the mist. I never saw him afterwards. At least I never kept no track of him. Maybe he might have been shipped out too. He might have been shipped to a different base, like McCall, Idaho, or gone up to, if he was as tough as he said, he might have even gone up to Alaska. They had a select crew for those. I think they were sending him up to Alaska then. Quite sure they were. And so he might have gone on a special crew. They might have even sent him to Redding. They have Smoke Jumper Base in Redding, California. I don't know. I know they used to talk about, in our bunch, they used to talk about if you jumped in the woods and out of Redding, you really knew you were in some big timber, of course, because you were in with, you know, potentially redwoods and high, very high timbers. So that pretty well covers that. I can't. Well, I can remember minor incidences, but that's, I think, one of the highlights.
Are there any other specific characters that you remember?
Particular characters? Well, this fellow, this Crow, one I mentioned in the written report, he was an ex-paratrooper, I guess, out of Fort Benning originally. Had his training in Fort Benning. And he swan-dived out right after me, and I guess as a result he was falling faster than myself because he went through my lines. But he was the one that had the presence of mind to tell me to take out my emergency knife and cut the shroud lines away. So after he was cutting and I was looking at him mask to mask, almost eyeball to eyeball, my bunny, he kind of impatiently ordered me. He says, well, take out your knife and start hacking away those lines like that, you know, we were sailing down, right, going right together, you know. First, I was tempted to crack my emergency chute. I wasn't thinking. But fortunately, I didn't do that, or that just balled us all up worse. And so I cut away with him on the lines, and wind took him away from me, and And but I do, I recall, I heard some cheering, so all the people down below, which looked like an army bunch down there, with all the chutes draped over the trees. It looked like tents down there. And they must, well, they dropped quite a large number. I think it was one of the biggest fires. I'm quite sure it was 100, maybe it was over 100, and that would make, what, about four C-47 loads? I forget the, I think it's 25 in a C-47 load. And so I guess it was approximately 100 with four C-47 loads. So it looked like a big army camp down there, and I heard all this cheering, you know, rake, good show, and all this business. And this crow, whether he was Indian descent or what, I don't know, whether that was his English name, I don't rightly know, but he went on safe down the hill, and I landed safe. That was, he's pretty well, I've remembered him off and on, thought about that incident off and on over the years.
How much time did it seem like you had while you were falling?
Well, it was surprisingly long. I think they must have dropped us fairly high on that one, because we seemed to have plenty of time to get all this accomplished. And I'd remembered then, when he'd mentioned cutting lines, I'd remembered in our training something about, they said to the effect that if you'd cut every line off the chute, and you left about only three evenly spaced, you know, all the way around, that the silk was strong enough to hold you up anyway, hold the chute in position. So we had nothing to worry about. We didn't have that many lines to do away with.
Were there ever any other incidences that you can remember while you were working that happened to you or any of the other jumpers?
No, well, no. I don't know if I'd recall this. I think it was Mr. Brower that was, he was in the office, and I heard this secondhand that he came down on a mountaintop, jumped, and it was a high updraft, I mean a strong updraft, and he came down, and instead of hitting hard, his toes touched the ground, and his chute was still billowed out, and then he just gradually just sunk on his heels. That's how strong the updraft was. I guess it was coming from maybe both sides or something. It wasn't blowing him in any direction. He just sort of had a beautiful landing. Just ended up just right on his feet. Never had to make what they called, they had what they called the Marine Allen roll that we had to practice all the time. And that was when you were coming in, you twisted your legs around and then fell on one hip. And then this was all to distribute the weight, get the shock off from your body, evenly distributed. And so you'd end up with your feet over your head, and that would sort of bring you to a skidding stop if the whole works, or if the wind was, say, at high velocity and moving it pretty fast. After you hit, you'd come to quite a stop, because you ended up with your feet over your head and your toes digging into the ground, so you came to quite an abrupt stop. The wind didn't, say, drag you very far that way.
Were there ever any injuries that you can remember?
Well, no, not other than what I'd already mentioned. I covered that quite thoroughly. The only real jump that I didn't mention was they had a Pepsi-Cola Skyrider crashed out here. Actually, if you look from Van Buren Street, almost due north, you'll spot Stewart Peak. And it was somewhere in the saddle, either right of Stewart Peak or left of Stewart Peak. Some young fellow came up Missoula, Johnson Field, with a low-wing plane. He was a Skyrider, and he crashed up there. And I was on the top of the stick. I was out, based out at the airport at this time. And so we just stood on the front steps of the office there, and we could see the smoke, actually. That's how close it was. It wasn't the other side of the chain of mountains. It was right this side, and it was right in the saddle. And we could see this big column of smoke, white smoke, as I remember, billowing up from the saddle there. So they said, "There's your fire." And so we went out. I forget which kind of plane it was. I don't recall. I think it was a Travel Air on that one. And it wasn't a very big fire. It was an awfully small fire. So they dropped me and this other fellow. As I remember, I only recall that it was just myself and another young man. There was the wreckage of the plane. The aluminum wings were all melted, but the gasoline was still flaming from the wing tanks. But the fire was nothing. We had it out in no time. I guess they dropped another load or two or three loads or something, and so we had more crew help than we needed. And after we put this real small fire out, we spent most of our time just gossiping and talking about old times and et cetera and so on. And but I do remember one ghoulish member, I think he was from back east, took a shell. He said, as a joke, I don't even know whether maybe I should mention this, but he took a shell. He says, "I want to see what that fellow looks like." He was still, the pilot was still strapped in the seat and upside down. And, so they released him, at least the CAA, I believe, officially released him later. So maybe he wasn't released, because I suppose we were ordered not to touch anything. So the CAA got up there, and this kid took a shovel and just pried this slab of aluminum off the off the pilot's face. And of course, there was nothing but a skull there. There was nothing, no features. But he was awful young. He's, I don't know, 17 or 18. It's kind of ghoulish, but maybe that's why I didn't mention it. It was rather ghoulish. But we had the fire out in no time, and so I had quite a bit of time on my hands, and so did everybody else. So I don't know if I went along with a CAA investigator or what, but I walked out where the path of the plane first started, and I could see that the pilot was clipping the tops off the trees, and then pretty soon he was knocking whole trees down, and pretty soon he ended with a tree that was about maybe 3 feet in diameter, and he just couldn't go any further, and so he was crumpled to melted aluminum mass right there at the base of that tree, and it was just almost the top of the saddle of the mountain. He almost made it over. It was a little stream, I believe, when I was going by. Yes, as a matter of fact, it was a little stream near the crash. That was the extent of it. It was written up in the Missoulian. As a matter of fact, I found it here at the library in the on tape. And I have a black and white copy, reverse copy from a Xerox. I have a copy of it, not very good copy of the news article on it. Happened just before Labor Day. Well, actually, yes, the day before Labor Day. And we were up there through Labor Day, just preceding when they were ready to release us for school, go back to either high school or go back to the university.
Can you tell us a little bit about your first fire jump?
That's rather, I have them all mixed up in my mind, and so I don't.
A particular fire jump that stays in your mind?
Yes, well, I did, I mentioned. Do you want me to repeat all? Do you mind to repeat on it?
Because
all I can do is just repeat. I can't recall. This one that I just, that was one I was just saving, the one up there at, near Stewart Peak.
Okay.
And that's the only one.
What other details did you have besides firefighting?
I did have, I'd mentioned pitching hay for the mules. I guess Stu had some old dynamite. I was about the only other. That sort of sticks in my mind. That was my first experience with high explosives. So I guess somewhere, we were clearing stumps, but they had, I guess, some dynamite. Old dynamite they were getting rid of, so we set off a bunch of dynamite here where we were blowing stumps. It's rather vague in my mind what that project was exactly, but as I recall now, it was concerned with clearing land and blasting stumps with dynamite. We had that sure somewhere near Nymon Camp. And
you were actually involved with the blasting?
No, they had a munitions expert. That was the extent of it. But we were observing this. That was me all. I mentioned that bear incident. I mentioned this jump in Idaho where we had an extremely high wind and they dropped us. On that jump in Idaho, 500 feet, I thought that was the lowest I ever dropped. And but then in talking with other people, I found out that among the jumpers, they said that they dropped them, actual Army jumpers, they dropped them as low as 300 feet. So that wasn't really so low that we dropped.
What's the difference between dropping from a high elevation and from a low elevation?
It was quite a thrill. It was just no sooner I had the chute open than racing just parallel with the ground. It was no time that we were down. I was quite fortunate in all my landings. I either landed in a tree or I landed hard, maybe hard, but I landed where it wasn't so hard it injured me. I never came out with any strains or sprains or anything like that. So, and I always kind of welcomed a tree landing because it was very soft. We were well protected, of course, with those canvas suits. And weighed 150, I believe that's correct on the. I'm pretty shaky on numbers, but I believe I'm correct in saying it was about 150 feet of rope in our right pocket, big, huge canvas pocket on the side of our canvas suit. And of course then our football helmet and our steel grid mask and a pair of thick gloves. So we had no problems in meeting up with trees at all. It was a featherbed landing for me. I liked it.
What were some of your off-duty activities during training?
Oh, we'd go down to the 9 Mile Bar quite a bit. Actually, that 9 Mile Bar has hardly changed whatsoever. I was up there just to visit and look at the building and the interior of it. And it was very comforting to see that they kept the building like it used to be, 47. Kind of made a person feel at home up there. I'd almost swear they had almost the same selection of pictures on the wall. I was probably kidding myself, but I looked at some of the decor in there and I could have swore it was almost exactly the same as they had in the 40s.
Did the guys ever go into Missoula?
Oh, sure, quite often.
What would they do in Missoula?
Oh, well, we did go to all those dances. Moose Hall was really popular. And we enjoyed dating the nurses at St. Pat's. That was, at least among my friends, that was the biggest opportunity we had, was to go up to the nurses' training, or the nurses' quarters, and date a nurse. So we all had dates among the nurses, or at least it seems to me we did. Yeah, I might have it mixed up in my mind because, of course, attending the university, I believe we still were dating nurses. So I'm not completely sure on that. I went back to my fraternity and I read the logbook. I did some cartoon illustrations back from those days, and I did pictures of some of the people I knew dating girls, and I didn't see any mention made of nurses, but I think we, even at the university, we were still dating nurses. And we go swimming a lot, the old pool down here. We'd go out to Missoula Pool on weekends. That was quite a lot of fun for us at that age. I was 18, of course, I was pretty young. And, that's about the extent of it.
And what about the off-season activities?
Well, just studying at the university is about all I can remember. I got interested in classical music. I remember I spent one Christmas here at the university, stayed here listening to classical music. I had the whole fraternity house to myself, and with a roaring fireplace. I had a nice little fireplace in there, and so I got a bunch of records I bought, the old masters, and spent the whole Christmas season just listening to classical music. Well, I had a girlfriend that lived right next door, and that was one of the reasons probably I stayed too. I believe we went out Christmas Eve for dinner, and we went dancing. We used to dance at the Momart. Now, it's in the basement of this Missoula Apartments. It was a very nice club then, in the basement there with slot machines. And I can still remember the slot machines in the Momart. I don't know if they had them in the Flame. The other two bars were the Flame and the Merle's. And we go in there quite often at Merle's. And we danced at the Park Hotel. This is all connected with the university. Then in the winter, we'd go to the Park Hotel and dance, and listen to the music. Go to the Palace Hotel and dance. I think they had dancing there. And I don't recall, winter sports weren't all that popular then, so I don't recall any skiing. We never went out, like that. Actually, hunting wasn't so, at least among university students, or among the people I knew among the university students, there was no hunting done, and I never went out hunting, I never went skiing then, nothing like that. Actually, I don't think they even had the snowball set up by then. One of the members of our fraternity house, though, surveyed the land up at Whitefish for a big mountain. Top skier. He was, I guess, a wonderful skier. He actually came back one season badly injured from skiing. He had his leg in a cast. This was severely broken. And he went up there and actually plotted the ground, which is presently the Big Mountain Ski Resort.
Now most of the guys on the smoke jumping crew, were they college students?
Everybody I knew, uh-huh. And I had mentioned, there were, of course, the servicemen that were returning. There's still some of those servicemen. What they did in the winter, we had a lot of servicemen here living like in Jumbo Hall. That was the barracks, like a Quonset Hut barracks. And I think that was built for servicemen, quarters for servicemen. At least it was additional housing for, I guess, well, later it became serviceable for everybody. But anyway, there were a lot of servicemen also attending the university course. So That pretty well answers that question. Can't recall any other details. But I was only here. So it was about two quarters of the first season, and two quarters of the second season. So, actively in the university, I spent close to half a year. I was reading philosophy. I was checking books out of the city library. I wasn't attending the university. And just doing reading on my own. Reading books out of the local Carnegie Library. Which is presently, by the way, it's an art museum over there now. So, the old Carnegie building.
Can you describe a typical jump?
I know that the sound of the motors would lull me. I was kind of nervous, maybe, or maybe with high anticipation. The roar of the motors seemed to drown everything out. Yeah, those older planes were. I don't think there was soundproofing on them at all, and so you had the three engines on the tri-motor, and you had single engine on the travel air, and they were pretty loud motors, and so I found that it sort of kind of lulled me a little bit, and when we would hook our line on to the static line, or hook our cord onto the static line, clamp onto the static line, I was ready to go. I had no problem leaving whatsoever. As soon as they'd pat me on the back, I'd just step right off the step, and if I was in rather the first position, I would. Or in, say, like the C-47, I'd just follow the man out that was ahead of me, just go right on. As I recall, is on those older planes, C-47, we'd go out one at a time. So I seem to recall, sure, they'd have to. But I mean, on the C-47, we just go more or less out. They'd pat each one of us as we were standing up. Whereas in the travel air or the tri-motor, we'd put one foot on the step and kneel and have our hands out on the sides of the door, and then we received this pat from the spotter. As soon as he left his drift chutes out to see what the velocity of the wind was, and by then we'd line up, get in the step there, and he'd pat us on the back, and we'd just step out and go. That's all there was to it.
How did they decide who jumped first?
I don't know. I don't think there was any real selection at first. I don't believe there was. I mean, at least as far as I know. There wasn't any preference.
And once you got on a fire, what were the general fire procedures?
Well, they dropped nearly everything. We dropped big chests. They dropped a radio. They dropped the tree climbers and saws and all that. Wrapped them up very carefully. A lot of it was free fall too, as I recall. On some items, they just the plane would just go over quite low, and they just throw them out the door. But they'd have them selectively wrapped and. Other items, maybe tents or something like that, or sleeping bags of that nature, and that would cushion the force of the impact. And nearly every fire I can recall, we'd have a radio operator, somebody setting up the radio. I seem to always recall somebody setting up one of those Army style tube radios. I think they were even Jeep radios. I believe I had one on last course later. I had my ex-wife on lookout out of Redding on Fall River Mills. Fall River Mills was a town, but it was Lassen National Forest. On lookout, we had what they told me was a Jeep radio out of a World War II Jeep up there with those old C batteries, I think they're called. Not C, but those big ones they used to use for old-fashioned doorbells, you know, those tall batteries, those round ones. Well, about 10 or 20 years. By the end of the season, you had a big collection of those old, used up, 1.5 volt batteries. But anyway, getting back to the jumpers, I remember them setting up a radio, it seems like every fire. You know, they'd have to report to the pilot, or they'd have to report in someplace. Keep radio contact, anyway.
So what would you do after you landed?
Oh, just, no problem. We just leave our gear there. We wouldn't even worry about it. As I recall, I never, to my mind, never bothered about, from the word go, getting the chute out of the tree or anything like that. We just, if it was on the ground, we'd roll them up so the wind wouldn't blow them. After we got out of the harness and everything. And then we just meet in a group in the center, and then the crew boss check us out, see who was there, and then we'd look the fire over, walk over to the fire, and I suppose by approximately that time, then the plane would be dropping out our equipment. And of course, the crew leader would oversee that. I suppose the first thing, well, logically speaking, they probably dropped the radio. And then he'd tell them whether, I guess, if there were any injuries or any equipment missing, or what equipment showed up and all this business. And that was it. And then we'd leave for the fire with our Pulaski and shovel, axe, and start building a fire trail, knocking down snags, burning snags, and so forth. I mean, the ones that were close to the perimeter of the fire, cutting maybe those down. Mostly building just the trail to surround the fire as soon as possible, so it wouldn't get away from us and crown out. That would be our top priority, would be the trail, of course. And of course, the foreman would pretty well select who would have which tools. Like certain numbers would have a Pulaski, certain numbers of us would have a axe, certain numbers of us would have a shovel. And as I recall, the Pulaski, I haven't fought fire since Swan Lake, and that was 72. So as I recall it, that's 12 years ago. Pulaski in front, and then shovel, and then of course the axeman cutting the overhanging brush off from the trail so we can jump across the trail line, or the fire line. And water carriers, we have. I was selected several times for hauling water up. We had those big canvas water bags. We went on to the nearest creek and fill it with water and bring it up for the crews. So they also dropped us water bags. Canteens we usually had, well, that was on foot crew. I don't know if anybody had ever dropped out of a parachute with a canteen on his belt, but so I won't say that they did that, but they did have, yes. And then they'd have those portable water squirters. Those had to be filled at the creek. And that was about the extent of it. I don't recall any borate being used until about 1963 or 62, earlier. Either 61 or 62, in California, were using borate on fires. That was the first experience I had with that method of fighting fire.
And what were some of the after-fire procedures?
That's kind of hazy in my mind. Probably the measurement. I have somebody appointed as mark off the number of chains. And then the crew foreman with the map plot out the shortest trip down to the nearest road where they pick us up with the trucks and take us back. Maybe sometimes they might have left a man to watch. In some cases it seems like we'd be pulled off of the fire and it would still be a little bit warm. I assume would leave somebody up there to put it out, perhaps, I'm not sure. But the plan was to, of course, never leave it until it was completely out. We had to, I don't know if they still do it nowadays, but in those days we had to go through our hands after we fire looked completely out. Then we'd go through with a shovel and start digging up within the fire line and then go through it with our hands to make sure there were no hot sparks. We did that pretty often. As a matter of fact, I can't remember a fire we didn't do that. Nearly every one I attended, I did that myself. Then just head down for the waiting trucks, and then we just haul right back in to the nearest port, so to speak. Like up in, we came out of Medellin Falls. We came by train. We went through Sand Point, Idaho, and ended up at the old Milwaukee station. We were either taken to Johnson Field out of the fairgrounds, or we were taken out to 9 Mile. We were at the top of the stick. We'd go out to the fairgrounds once again. Of course, that wouldn't be logical. After one jump, we'd be at the bottom again. That's right. So then we'd go to 9 Mile, and say, for instance, in the case of Medellin Falls, Washington, where we were clearing slash after a logging crew up there on a wet season. 78 was a very wet season. 48, rather. Very wet season. And so we came back by Milwaukee Road. At least we ended up at Milwaukee Road and went back to 9 Mile by truck.
What was the general atmosphere after a fire?
Oh, pretty much elation, I guess. Feeling of accomplishment, I think, and thanksgiving that we were, feeling of thanks that we were not injured or anything. And we'd be thinking about getting back into town and having some fun, of course, like going out dancing once again, or date the nurses from St. Pat's, or go swimming.
What kind of reactions did you get from your friends and family when you decided to become a smoke jumper?
Oh, well, I think my mother was pretty pleased. Maybe she was worried I might turn out to be kind of a, what they used to call in those days, sort of a panty waist. Because I was her only surviving child, and I myself supporting the both of us. So maybe she was quite happy that I got into some kind of work like that. She probably thought it would be good for me. I don't recall her ever saying this, but I would assume that she was quite happy. The new local newspaper, I don't know if my mother told them about it, but the local newspaper got a hold of one letter, I guess, that I'd written. Must have been my mother turned it in. They were going to write it up. I never paid any attention whether they did or not. I think Shelby Promoter up there did print the letter. I guess they thought that was a pretty big thing up there. And as I'd mentioned with the C-47 that brought us to Medellin Falls, that was an awful primitive strip, and there were a large group of people out there, and they seemed to be highly impressed that I assume that a plane of that size actually landed on that strip, because we had a very short running space, and it was a dirt road crossing a logging road. And as I recall, somebody had said the rules were for what reason, I don't know, but the rules were that the pilot was supposed to, at least that's the story they told me, pilot had to apply his brakes before approaching that logging road that bisected the airstrip at right angles, complete right angle.
After your last season as a smoke jumper, I believe in 1949, they had the Man Gulch fire.
Oh, yeah, I heard.
And what kind of sentiments evolved after that incident?
Well, I thought I'd lost my foreman, one of my foremen, but I found out later I was in error. I made a mistake. Somebody told me that one of the men, we called him Hank Shank. We had quite a few character-type names like that. Like, one fellow was Smokey, and I'd worked with him on the St. Regis, and that was a cabinet national forest. He was Smokey, and then we had Hank Shank as foreman. Well, somebody came up to me and told me that Hank Shank had died in the fire, and I'd always thought of this. And then it was just when I got back to Missoula here this time that I had mentioned this to somebody, and they told me that Henry Shank was alive and well, so... It was just a rumor, false rumor. But I was sort of disturbed about that. I didn't know Mr. Shank very well, but that's sorry to hear about it. I'm disappointed to hear about it, about him dying in the fire. Now, it was quite a blow.
Did that change your ideas about smoke jumping?
Oh, no, not really. No, I'd been brought in a week, I guess it was maybe 2 or 3 weeks. I was out at 9 Mile at 49, but I guess it was a misunderstanding. They thought I was studying forestry, and by that time I was majoring in art. I turned to art the second year here at the university. And, somebody called me in and said something to the effect they thought I was majoring in forestry. And so I was let out after that. So I went into the Region 1 office and asked for another job. But I never returned to smoke jumping after that. Well, I got interested in fine art, I guess. By then, I guess I was mostly interested in the intellectual side of life, and I was looking at my life as not in physical work, but in my life, looking at the future of my life in intellectual work. So I think there was a period of time there where I just never thought about the smoke jumpers.
Do you think that your experiences as a smoke jumper affected the rest of your life?
Well, I think it did, because I did try to keep some, at least some kind of a sport in mind. I tried to keep active in some kind of a sport, keep in shape, and instead of being a bohemian type, let's say, starving in a garret or something like that, not sure. I always kind of remained true to keeping physically fit. That's about all I can say on that.
Do you find that your experiences as a smoke jumper affect your art in any way?
Well, actually, yes. I did start doing some drawings. I did some nature scenes. I remember, one C-47 trip, and we were flying around a mountain, and the plane was banking real steeply, so much so that the centrifugal force, you couldn't even get out of your seat. Pilot was, I presume, was selecting a fire drop or something at the top of this mountain. But I was very much impressed by the scenery. We were low enough where I could distinctly see a lot of scenery down there. And I did a drawing after that. And I think I still have it, as a matter of fact. That could have been the instigation for actually turning into the fine art field, turning to the fine art field, changing from medicine.
In what way do you feel like that it was a catalyst in making that decision?
Oh, that's hard to say. I have a mental picture of the plane and the scenery below, and that's about the extent of it. I can't remember any of the details about it. I consider myself to have a pretty poor memory. I always have had quite a poor memory. So,
do you have any other stories that you'd like to share with us?
No, not really. Well, related to this, I went up as recently as 78 or 79, I went up to Bob Marshall to try to find that cave. And went up to Holland Lake, packed in over a high area there that still has a glacier on it, and picked up Gordon Creek Pass to head for Big Prairie. I finally had figured out from previous seasons up there, for instance, like I worked for a outfitter camp up there, and I was down at Black Bear, and they had a landing strip at Black Bear, which is in the wilderness. And I thought, well, this might have been where that fire was with the cave. But then I dismissed that from my mind, because I looked over the mountain area where I was quite sure the fire had been, and it didn't look familiar. So I thought, well, it must be Big Prairie. I looked on my map, and I figured, well, none of these strips are used anymore, as I understand. So I figured, well, it must be then Big Prairie. So I headed over Gordon Pass, heading for Gordon Creek Pass, heading for Big Prairie, to see if I could just stumble across this cave just by accident. I finally had to turn back. I was wearing short pants, and the horseflies were eating me up, so I canceled the idea out. I was going to spend maybe a couple weeks more, see if I could find it. I only had this one change of clothes, and so I thought, well, I'll just come back. So I returned to Holland Lake and came back to Missoula. Then I was talking with this taxidermist on California Street. Told him, and he says, "Sure, I know what cave you mean." I said, "Well, you're not referring to a hole in the wall cave. That's on the maps near Big Prairie." And I thought he was in error, but he said, "No, I know the one you mean. It's not that hole in the wall." He said he passed it dozens, literally dozens of times, and he never noticed it because it was covered by a big bush. And finally, one day, he just came across it. That's why I didn't see it, because the bush covered the entrance so well. And that cave had a grizzly bear living in it. And we'd stayed that night, and the grizzly bear was in the cave. We'd thrown our sleeping bags down right at the entrance of the cave and spent the night with that old grizzly bear there as a companion, an unknown companion, because it was late at night. We had no inkling whatsoever there was a cave there. We were tired. Took the first level spot we could find. Just happened to be the landing right out to the from the entrance of this nice little cave. So I thought that has definitely remained in my mind. I thought that was very interesting, because I'd been at Limestone Cave, and that's at the northern border of the Bob Marshall Wilderness. And this cave is almost evenly distributed, equal distance from border to border. Would be, what is it, about 150 miles from the north border to the south border of Lincoln, from Spotted Bear to Lincoln. So that would be 75 miles approximately that Big Prairie is located, 75 miles. So it's almost right in the middle of the wilderness.
So this cave with the grizzly bear, this was during a fire jump?
That was that. That's the one where they took us up in the only one I can definitely remember. We were in a travel air, the one that did have that like a Ford Model T with basic black, kind of dull basic black, if you've ever seen a Model T from those years, where you know exactly what I mean. Well, that's how this travel air was painted. They had that basic black with a top wing and a radial engine. And an old plane, probably built in the 30s, early 30s. And so we dropped on the top of this ridge, and there was a sheer wall straight up and down from the top, and they had quite a problem finding that. Well, it was just a pilot, as I recall. I don't believe they had a co-pilot. Those little travel airs, it was so small. They just, as I recall, they had two jumpers. I know they had two jumpers. And I know they had a spotter, but whether they had a co-pilot, I don't think they did. So anyway, so the pilot had quite a problem, and the spotter had quite a problem finding it. Where to drop us. Finally, they picked a spot. We walked over to where this cliff was, and we had to let ourselves down with rope to get to the fire, because it was a sheer cliff. The fire was at the base of this cliff on the top of the mountain. And the fire was at quite an angle, too. But we put out the fire, and then in no time, because it was real small, then we had the chore of finding a place to sleep, because we had no level. We didn't want to climb up that rope back on top of the level area on the top of the mountain, so we scouted around and found this little level patch and went right to sleep, because it was, I think it was about at least 9 or 10 o'clock at night, maybe more. Very dark. Overcast, I believe, may have been overcast. At least there were no light, no brilliant moon or no bright stars or anything that I recall. So we never even noticed that darn cave until the ranger went up. And he was, as I had recalled in the written report, he was everything. He was a jack of all trades. He was his own alternate ranger. He was his own packer, his own cook, his own telephone man. And he'd go off at like 2 weeks a stretch, he had that much time on his hands, and just go fishing. He's a great guy, too. I mean, really. He was glad to have some company anyway, and so he really rolled out the welcome mat and put on a big feed for us, as I recall, and then he went up the... We arrived in the morning. We picked up this trail right into the Big Prairie Ranger Station in no time. And, we had an easy walk out. So the trail led right into it. And he went up either the next day or whenever, got our gear, and said to us when he got back, he says, "Well, boys," he said, "I sure wish you'd been with me. It's right where you slept that night. It was at the entrance of the cave." Standing bolt upright in the entrance of that cave was a silver muzzle old grizzly bear. He had wished that we'd seen the sight. I wished so too. That's why I guess I went back. Because by then I was getting sort of intrigued with caves. I'd met spelunkers up there when I worked at Spotted Bear, and when I worked for this outfitter fellow, hunter outfitter fellow, and they said they were these spelunkers were parked in the car, and they said they were heading out. They were at the entrance of the cave, heading out to Limestone Cave. They were going to check it out. And so by that time, I was getting very much interested in caves. And that was in '69 when I'd seen them. Now when I got back here to Missoula in '76, then I was. And I had all this time I could spend. I was very highly interested in getting up there and seeing if I could find that cave.
Are there any big differences that you notice in the way the smoke jumpers are run today compared with how they were run when you were a smoke jumper?
Well, I knew for a stretch they were using nothing but helicopters. Sort of took the glory out of it. From there on, I thought, well, heck, it's no fun no more. Then I next heard that they brought back those like a Canadian plane using a Canadian what is it called, a Nordmaster or something like that. Is that the name?
I don't
something
know.
Like that. At any rate, it's a Canadian-built airplane. And they were dropping them again. Parachutes, so that sounded a little more like it. But at the advent of those helicopters, I thought, oh my gosh, there's nothing to that. Anybody can do that. So they switched again, back to jumping, as I understand. I've been out there at the new quarters, and so I know that they're back again. I've talked with them. Back again using parachutes.
Do you have any observations about the attitude of the smoke jumpers today?
Well, that's kind of surprising I even know anything about, because I haven't talked with any of them. Like the people I dropped with that are still in town, where they've gone on to other fields. Like one's a realtor. Well, two of them are realtors, and married, and families, and everything. I'm the only one that's single right at present. But I went out on bicycle out to the new base out there, the one that President Eisenhower wasn't himself dedicated that. Was President Eisenhower dedicated? New base out there. That was after I was gone. I went out there by bicycle, and I saw one of the jumpers was pedaling one of those unicycles. That's a great way for physically building himself up. That's magnificent. He certainly built himself up in perfect shape that way, I would imagine. I imagine it's very strenuous. Takes a lot of balance. You only used to see people in carnivals who were able to pedal a unicycle, so it must be a whole different crew now. I wouldn't recognize him, wouldn't be able to even talk with him. It's a whole new ball game then, I guess. I have never been. I've been here 7 years now, this stretch. But I haven't talked to a single fellow that said he's a new man just jumping on a team. So I don't know.
Is there anything else you might like to add before we conclude this interview?
No, not really. Well, then I guess we were pretty gung-ho. We used to wear a shirt. Everybody had T-shirts in those days. Everybody wore T-shirts. They'd wear, usually invariably, they'd wear like a brown sort of army-type twill shirt. No epaulettes on them, but it was very close to the army shirt, army brown. And then Levi's. That was universal. Everybody had Levi's, two or three pairs or more of Levi's. A pair of nice boots, and that was it. But everybody had these white T-shirts, and then somebody in the rigging crew had a stencil. So we'd go into the where they'd rig the chutes, and we'd stencil our T-shirts with a couple pairs of wings and then a parachute in the middle of the parachute would be flanked by the wings, you know, and so we'd go into those dances, and oh wow, did we really think we were something? Woo! Yeah, we thought we were the greatest. And we'd go over the bridge, and so of course the whole design was to attract the girls. To be perfectly frank about it, as we thought that was pretty classy to have this design on our T-shirts. Everybody I recall had at least one of those T-shirts designed with these wings and the open chute in the middle. I think there was maybe even lettering on them. At least that's, I think it had the Forest, also the Forest Service was stenciled. The Forest Service symbol also was stenciled in there someplace.
Was there a typical humor associated with the smoke jumpers?
Oh, yes, I think so. I don't know, I can't recall any practical jokes or anything like that, but gosh, I can't remember. I can't remember an amusing incident offhand. Might later, but I can't offhand.
Were there any other kind of fads besides these T-shirts?
Pardon me?
Were there any other kind of fads besides these T-shirts?
No. Oh, well, army clothes of any nature. Like, I remember I showed up there. My relatives had bought me one of those leather jackets for high school, and I showed up at the jumper camp with this leather jacket, and a fellow had a real nice, so I was quite practical, this fellow had a real nice but warm naval jacket, and it was in green though, but it was a sheep-lined naval jacket, very well cut and everything, so I traded him. He wanted the leather jacket, he liked the leather jacket, and I didn't really care for that leather so much, so I traded him the leather jacket for the practical naval jacket. Turned out it was a wise move because cold evenings on the top of a mountain, that jacket was much better than that leather jacket would have been. So that was really the only thing I can recall that was sort of distinctive. It seemed like everybody or nearly everyone had some, at least one item that was connected with the service. Service was still of interest to us, and several of us had just missed the service and had been hoping that maybe we might have gone into the service, like as a pilot or something of that nature. So that's where that leather jacket came in. I, on, I believe, was I was I picked that out because it referred to the Army pilots, referred to the Army service as a pilot. And pay rations, of course, we had maybe sort of a kid's interest in K rations, taking the cigarettes out of the K rations, and keeping those little packets. And everything tasted very good because, you know, it was sort of exotic. Compared to a regular meal, like in a cook shack, we'd have these kind of exotic candy bars or those fruit bars. And they were kind of mysterious because they had a lot of food. Build up the vitamin content, but they had quite an unusual mixture. For instance, the fruit bar, I don't know, maybe had six or eight different fruits mixed in and some other items. There was chewing gum in the kit, the old K-ration. We'd eat all the parts of the K-rations. Because it was kind of it was like going to the store and getting a treat for us on the fire. At least for me it was, too. I mean, and I think some others, too, felt the same way. That's about all I can do to sum up. Probably when I get away, I'll think of maybe one item I wish I'd mentioned. But that's basically it.
Well, I'd like to thank you for this interview.
Oh, you're darling welcome. Enjoyed it.